The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private. Trust Ireland's leading private hospitals with locations nationwide, including Dublin, Cork and Limerick.
This is News Talk.
Good morning to Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. Luke, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, there's always news, and the latest news I got last night watching CNN was Regeneron have announced some results of the miracle drug that got Donald Trump back on his feet.
That's right, yeah. But I mean, a big trial was published last night, 800-patient trial with the drug that, as you say, Trump himself got. And it worked, Pat, in the trial that it reached what's called the endpoint, which is really good, obviously, when they see a success here. What they did, Pat, was interesting. It was people who were, say, positive, and then they gave them the like Trump, in a sense. And there were 57% fewer visits to the hospital or doctors. In other words, the drug seemed to stop the disease. And then in ones who are vulnerable, like if you'd say a heart condition or obese, like Trump, there was a 72% decrease in need for clinical care, you know, and that was the specific endpoint in the trial. So what that trial tells us, Pat, is if you get this early, it should slow the virus in its tracks, really. Now the big question is going to be, can you make enough of it? They've made 50,000 doses so far. That's not going to go very far. They're difficult to make, these antibodies, actually. They aren't as straightforward as a vaccine. So the next question is going to be, can we get supply? And now, meanwhile, there's more trials still running. So Regeneron are still saying, well, look, hold on, let's wait for the next couple of trials before we actually sort of launch this more globally, you know.
I wonder, will they look for emergency use? Because obviously there are people around the White House generally who may succumb to this, given the lack of discipline in terms of the COVID measures. And, you know, if the vice president should fall prey to it, he has been around people who are very positive yet he campaigns ahead. But, you know, would they look for emergency use for someone like him?
I bet they're on it, Pat. It wouldn't surprise me. They've given them in. Clearly Trump got it himself, right? So if you're in
you
this...
You think they're on it?
It wouldn't surprise me because it's safe, you know, and now it's showing efficacy. This is actually a repeat trial. So they've done a couple of other trials already, and this what's called reproducibility in our business, and luckily it's reproduced as an effect. So it wouldn't surprise me. And what the antibodies do, Pat, is very powerful. They lock onto the spike protein on the virus and mask it, a bit like the blue tack analogy we use sometimes. And then the spike can't stick into your lungs, so the virus can't get into your body. So it all makes scientific sense. And then meanwhile, the good news, Pat, as well, Lilly have a similar product. Several companies have a similar product, you know, that will block the spike. Mm. And this bodes well for those other ones as well.
Yeah, but they'll all be expensive to manufacture and therefore to purchase.
That's the trouble. Now, Trump said, Pat, he said everybody in America should, remember he said this, everybody in America should get access to this Regeneron drug. Now, how do you roll out a drug like that that's quite expensive to make? This will be the next challenge, I guess, that every country will face. Because if this is definitely working, why wouldn't everybody, and I mean, it's a bit naive, but everybody should get access. In other words, as soon as you're positive, you should take this drug. Or indeed, it can protect you from getting infected. There's another trial happening with the Lilly drug in nursing homes, and they're giving it prophylactically because it might actually stop the virus getting in the first place. Yeah. You know, so this is a really important development, I think.
Now, whatever about people in nursing homes who remain in nursing homes and are paying an arm and a leg for that privilege, whether the state is paying it or whether the Fair Deal is paying for it or whether they're paying for it out of their own pockets, if you can keep ordinary people who might be depending on the public health service, if you can keep them out of hospital, out of intensive care, the sums might actually add up.
Yeah, it's a huge saving. You know, in Ireland, at the moment, it's something like €1,000 a day to put someone into a hospital. Isn't that amazing? So that's the cost. So in other words, if you can keep people out of hospital or lower the time in, I remember the other drug we've discussed is remdesivir, which didn't really work in terms of mortality, but it did decrease hospital stay by 3 or 4 days. You're saving like $4,000 a patient then, you know? So there are economic benefits to these things, even though they seem to cost a lot of money up front. In the grand scheme of things, you could be saving money.
Now, tell me, Luke, why winter makes COVID-19 more dangerous for us?
Yeah, this is a really important study, Pat, to be honest. And I think this is going to be something for everybody to think about. It turns out that dry air is always bad for us because the viruses love dry air. And the common cold spreads in dry air more than moist air. And then secondly, if you're in a room and the air is very dry, your nose and your upper airways dry out. And viruses love that. They can latch on more and get into your body more. And this has been known for the flu and the common cold for years. And that's why when you go indoors in winter, these colds and flus spread more because the air is quite dry, as well as there being poor ventilation. So what this means is you've got to have humidity has become a key thing. And the big debate now is shifting. And I've seen lots of things on this in the last week. Ventilation is important indoors, of course, but you've got to try and keep the relative humidity up as well, because the virus, as I say, seems to thrive on dry air. Mm-hmm. So what they're going to recommend next, Pat, is, and this is a strong recommendation, you need to have plants in your room with water in them, or even a bowl of water will help keep the air a bit moist. But best of all is to buy a humidifier that will keep the air humid, yeah, and that will decrease the spread of the virus.
So you could imagine that restaurants and so on might invest in a humidifier which would humidify the air in the whole premises. It seems almost counterintuitive. You think, oh, summer, sun, why would the air be more moist in the summer when you've got heat and all of that to evaporate everything off, whereas in the winter you don't? But it's all about what the air can contain at particular temperatures.
But your engineering training, Pat, is a very complicated relationship, as you probably know, between temperature and humidity. It's not linear, for instance, you know, but you're right, that is a bit paradoxical, isn't it? But of course, the hottest places are often the most humid. As long as there's water in the around, shall we say, this will form into a, you know, increase the moisture of the air content, especially if the room is a bit warmer. So just having a slightly warmer room with a source of water, if you like, in a plant or in a bowl of water will help the air stay a bit moist. So it's a funny one, yeah. But what's happened there, Pat, is interesting. So when your nose dries out, or your upper airway dries out, you make less mucus, the stuff that, you know, makes you sniffle and so on. Mucus is a really good way to get rid of viruses, because it traps the virus and then you cough it out, you see. And then keeping the airway moist, if you will, and your nose moist, the virus slips, if you know what I mean, it can't get in. So therefore, if you're in a room and your nose is drying out, the virus loves that and will get into your body much more. So again, just keeping that moisture level up will now be seen. And if it goes down to 20%, you're in trouble, you know, relative humidity. It's got to be 40 to 60%. Now, these humidifiers are quite cheap, apparently. I just read this morning. You can buy them for 20, 30 euro if you can get into a hardware shop to buy them, I suppose. But they aren't expensive. But even if you don't want to buy one, literally having a bowl of water or a plant that you've watered, yeah, in a room will keep the air moist, you know.
And if you've got central heating in your house, you're going to have the temperature that will allow that water to evaporate readily into the atmosphere. Now, the other thing that is a bit disturbing is that in well-mixed spaces where you've got air movement around the place, that you're no safer from the airborne virus at 6 feet than 60 feet.
No, we've known that for a while, Pat. This frightens people, doesn't it? The 2 metre rule, we've all been clinging to that, haven't we? But the truth is, if you're in a stagnant air situation and the virus comes out of someone's mouth, it floats all over the room and can infect you even 600 feet away. There was a study showing this. You can detect virus 600 feet away from the source, hence the need for the ventilation. And ventilation has a massive effect on this, by the way, air exchange that we've discussed. So what's happening really is the engineers are saying, look, get the ventilation right, but make sure the air is, the relative humidity is at a certain level as well. And that's a really good combination then to keep a room safe and just, you know, stop this spreading all over the room kind of thing.
You've got a kind of two things fighting each other. I mean, you could sit outside on the terrace under an awning, maybe with patio heaters outside a restaurant, and you'd be outdoors. So therefore, that's good because the virus might be blown away a bit. But equally, it'll be very cold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're caught between the two. Yeah. The other one, Pat, that's good is if you wear a mask, or remember your mother told you to strap a scarf around your nose and mouth, right, when you were a child. That was good because it keeps the air moist in front of your mouth, right, and keeps your nose and your upper airways a bit moist, you see. And again, the virus doesn't like that. So it's another reason to wear a mask, actually. It's just to keep that air moist in front of your mouth, if you like. And a scarf will do the same thing, by the way. Wrap a good scarf around your nose and mouth. That keeps the air a bit moist and then keep your airways moist as well. And that's another way to
people who are walking or running or whatever wearing a mask complain that it gets very kind of soggy under the mask. Well, that's fine. That's good for you.
It's good for you. Exactly. Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
But one way or the other, mask wearing is best because it stops the stuff at the source, really.
By far, yeah. Now, remember, masks, there may be a 10% chance you'll pick up a virus even if you're wearing a mask, and we know this. And the dose of the virus will be lower anyway. But if you're keeping the air moist as well, even if you get a bit of virus in through the mask or the side of it, if the air is moist, it's less likely to get a foothold in your nose, you know, and therefore slips away, basically. So you're right, that's another, the two reasons to wear masks is to stop it spreading. But secondly, it might give you a little benefit as well, you see.
Now, I don't know whether, given that you live in Sandy Cove in County Dublin, whether you're one of those hardy people who goes to the 40 foot every morning. But those people, it turns out, are extremely clever.
Well, about again, this is brilliant. I mean, I think you and I have discussed this a couple of times over the years, having cold water swimming being very good for you. I mean, this has been known for a while now that jumping into cold water is beneficial. Obviously, you have to be careful. If you have a heart condition, you don't want to get a terrible shock. So we have to have a couple of cautionary tales. But by and large, the winter swimmers are remarkably healthy. This has been known for quite a while. And I've noticed, Pat, of you, lots of people are going in more. I mean, maybe you can't go beyond the 5K and you can't do your exercise in your gym. So why not jump into the sea? And I think my worry would be, Pat, the 40 foot, they could be a super spreading event. There's so many people down there, I've noticed, you know, so we've got to have less crowds, it'd be good. But there's a big breakthrough. This is a really good one. Why would cold water be good for you is sort of the scientific question. And one is, it gets your circulation going. And that's always great. And then your immune system is churning away. Really good study showing a dip in the sea in the cold will boost your immune response. It's fantastic. And the immune system likes that, you know. But now they've found a protein that goes up in the blood of people who jump into the water in the cold. And this protein has all kinds of benefits. It's called RBM3 is the name of it. And this really helps the brain. Now, we've always known there's a mental health issue about cold swimming as well. You get a lift from it, you know, and this stuff is beneficial to your brain. And even better, Pat, it staves off dementia. And there was evidence that, again, the cold winter swimming seemed to have less incidence of things like Alzheimer's, and they often wonder why that would be. And then it turns out, in the cold, you make this protein, RBM3, and that can protect your neurons in your brain. And they'd shown that in mice initially, actually. You can create Alzheimer's in a mouse, in a kind of an animal model, and RBM3 was protective, and that was evidence for this. But now they're getting a strong correlation with the level in your blood. You can measure this RBM3 protein. So that's another reason to go swimming, basically. So it'll be good for your overall immune system, I guess. But secondly, it might stave off things like dementia.
Now, people might think, well, I'll go for a brisk walk in the cold. That'll do me fine. But they did an experiment where they had a group of people who were going daily swimming in the cold water, and then another group of people who were right beside them doing Tai Chi on the bank of the swimming location. What happened?
This is what we call a well-controlled experiment in science, we call this way. So the people in London in the Lido, which is an outdoor swimming area, going in every day swimming, and then they had a group of people who did Tai Chi beside the cold water but didn't jump in. You know, so in other words, that was the control group. And the protein only went up in the ones who jumped in. Isn't that nice? So that was the evidence they were looking for. In other words, it could have been just a walk in the park, as you say, or a bit of exercise in the fresh air that could have been or something in the soil. Who knows, you know? But the fact is, it was the immersion in the cold water that drove this protein RBM3 in the blood of these people. That's why that's a good study, because, as I say, it's well controlled, you know, so it's a nice one. And now, of course, they're trying to come up with ways to boost this using, you know, possible new medicines, because you can imagine if you could drive that protein, everybody can't go jumping in the sea, can they? So if you could boost that protein in people who are at risk of Alzheimer's and just give them, you know, their health a general boost, that could be a very useful thing. So they're moving in that direction now with that study.
Now, I've just had an email from my own wife, Kathy, who wants me to ask you, does a cold shower have the same effect?
It does. That's good, Kathy. Yeah, I mean, if you get a cold shock, you've got to really suffer. That's a sad thing. I hate it. I can't go into the sea, even though I live near it. I feel ashamed, you know. But you got to go, oh, God, that's an unpleasant feeling, really, you know. And then if you've got to stay in for a few minutes, it's no good just jumping in and out of the shower. You've got to really shiver. You've got to become almost hypothermic, they've shown, by the way. In other words, you begin to get shiver and begin to feel quite cold. Just for a few minutes, though, you know, it's fine. And then this protein goes up. The longer you can stick it, basically, the more effect it will have on this protein.
Now, something interesting yesterday at the Oireachtas Committee, Dalton Phillips, the CEO of the DAA, was talking to them. And he mentioned that he'd been approached by a company that were offering very well-documented, very well-researched, very well-produced antigen tests that could be used at an airport for €6 a pop.
Yeah.
Is that the future?
This is brilliant. Absolutely. As you and I have discussed, this is a big weapon to get out of this. It's really accurate, reliable, easy to use tests. And those antigen tests are the way to go, because they take 5, 10, 15 minutes. It's a colour change of some kind. It's very simple to do. Anybody can kind of do it, you know. And if they can be done cheaply, and millions of them can be rolled out, and that could be, as you say, in that example, in the airport or wherever it might be, that has to be a massive add-on. And I was at a thing yesterday, Pat, about the travel business. Actually, I was asked to speak to some travel travel agent people. And it's very clear testing is the way to get travel back up. No question now. And that should be mission one, as we've been saying for a while. So that kind of antigen test you just mentioned, that's a superb add-on because it's cheap. It's people would bear an extra €6 on their ticket, wouldn't they, to be able to go to Portugal or wherever it might be. And if the test is, I think that particular test you mentioned is 98% accurate, which is really good. Yeah. You know, so in other words, it's reliable. So these are really good developments.
Yeah, I mean, the state of the art PCR test is one thing, but it's expensive and it has to be administered absolutely correctly. Remember, they had an issue in the White House where they got readings that were not correct because of the way the test was done and the way it was inserted into the machine, all that sort of stuff. You don't have that problem with the antigen test. So, you know, PCR might be state of the art, but it may not be necessarily, you know, in terms of its efficacy in giving results, depending on its administration. It should be administered by skilled people.
Yeah, you need to be trained.
Whereas the antigen test doesn't necessarily have to be.
But there's always a worry, Pat, that if you give it to people who aren't skilled, that there will be errors in those tests as well. They won't put the screw cap on. Even this sounds stupid, but people make mistakes doing these things. So there's always a slight concern about what we call operator error, whereas if it's a professional, it's more likely to be done correctly. But you can live with a certain level of error, remember. If you're 80% successful with this, that means, you know, you've decreased the risk of things happening by 80% or whatever. That's a really useful thing, you see.
Yeah. And the idea, too, we were talking about this last week. And if you have to keep people home from work because of a positive and so on among their colleagues, and therefore they might be paid 350 PUP for staying at home. If instead, every day when they're going into work, you give them an antigen test for a fiver or €6, the state would save an enormous amount of money.
Exactly, yes. And they must be doing those kind of, I hope we're doing. I mean, every country is in the middle of trying to get this right for all these reasons, you know. And I think it's still surprising it's not there yet. You know, it should be happening now in a sense. But we're all pretty confident this will become more and more a feature. And as I said to you know, every house, instead of being sent the iodine tablets, as we remember, you'll be sent 20 tests, you know, and it'll be in your hallway. And before you go out, you test yourself. And that's definitely going to be part of the future.
Yeah, and the idea that a child goes home from school with sniffles and is given, you know, a pack of tests and, you know, take them today, tomorrow, the next day, and all negative if they're the simple antigen test, and you're back in school on Monday.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It's hugely convenient. Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
Now, this is a genuine question I'm told by this News Talk texter. Could you ask Luke, are pubs a good venue for humidity since there's a lot of liquid in glasses?
Oh,
and he says, it is a genuine question.
Definitely. I mean, if even pouring pints, that's going to release a bit of, you know, it's going to increase the humidity rate, of course. And then people say, remember, Pat, humans exude sweat as well, remember. And that would increase humidity in a room too. So that's a good point. Yeah, maybe pubs can tick the box on humidity anyway.
Given what Professor O'Neill said about ventilation, how can children in classrooms with a COVID case not be deemed as close contacts? That's from Cormac.
Well, this is right. And every school is aware of this. I mean, you know, even opening the window, I mean, as many kids, I imagine, Pat, as we speak, sitting in cold classrooms, because, you know, all the schools are well aware of ventilation. And the most dangerous thing in this regard is stagnant air in a room, you see. So you definitely need ventilation. And it's okay to breach the 2 metre rule, you see, if there's good ventilation. It's like being outdoors and the virus is blowing away, you know. And then if you keep the air a bit moist as well, then you've got two things going on. So let's hope all the classrooms are, I'm sure they are, by the way, are compliant with this.
Final one from Catherine. So it seems all these hot houses that people are living in now are not good. We were better off when we had the old donkey jacket at the door to keep the draft out.
Not bad. Yes, that's right, to some extent. I mean, yeah. In other words, if you're stuffy, that's the worst thing to be in this situation. In a stuffy room, that's really bad, you know. And clearly, it's got to be, you know, you can't have it too hot either, or too cold. It's just, it's the usual thing. A bit of ventilation is fine, but don't make it stuffy and hot. That's a big negative.
Yeah. And if it's too cold, of course, then you have the problem that the air becomes very dry because the air being at low temperature cannot sustain moisture. And then you've got the virus saying, yippee.
Exactly, yeah.
So many stories, Luke. Luke, thank you very much for joining us with that. That's Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin.